Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. We have people from all over the world, and what I have found is we have so many hundreds of thousands of new listeners. I just want to remind you, if you're tuning in for the first time, the whole purpose of this hour is to empower people. We like to share things that you can do personally to live a longer and healthier life, a happier life. So we deal with self-empowerment issues. But we also take a look at social issues worldwide. We try to keep the theme so broad-based that no matter where you live, it still can make a difference. Today, for example, we're going to talk about black elderberry extract, attenuating inflammation, meaning bringing it down, University of Connecticut. We also will have how marigold extract can fight cancer, University of Alabama. How do 2 decades of data on 100,000 participants support the role of lutein and xanthine on lowering your risk of eye problems, macular degeneration, and that's from Harvard and Brown universities, and how probiotics can prevent recurring vaginal infections, and that is from ECHO and studies in the Netherlands, and we'll deal with that and a lot more on health and healing. Also, for those of you who believe that vaccines are both safe and effective, I'll share the latest from C.A. Shaw Global Research on the toxic impacts of aluminum contained in pediatric vaccines on the human nervous system. This is from the peer-reviewed toxicological journals, so you'll get that information. Also today, I want to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, since the president has now announced that he will sign it, and there's a movement to try to homogenize it into our consciousness, where we kind of hear it so often, and we'll have hundreds, if not thousands, of stories written on it, almost all pro. And this will come through scientists, academics, and people saying, it's good for us. And then one day we forget to look for anyone who opposes it. So we're going to have John Pildegar on today talking about it. Then I'll share some insights and information from Chris Hedges on this also. And then we are a nation that buys a lot of stuff. Do we need it? Why do we buy it? We'll talk about that, and you'll have a chance to share your points of view. And continuing with the in-depth discussion on how we're changing. I see it. I know many of you have seen it. We're changing in our attitudes. We should be changing to be more empathetic, more supportive, more caring about those who have less. We should be looking at ways we can take our wonderful resources and build communities where people who have committed a crime but should do constructive time, meaning work within the communities where there's a need, and therefore they can be both rehabilitated and pay a debt to society without the idea of being in a gang, in a prison, being raped. So I'm going to share some thoughts on how we have a promotional mindset for violence, but not for love. A special commentary from Henry Giroux. So let's begin, because we have a lot to share today. I want to begin by looking at one of nature's most perfect adaptogens. Now, adaptogen means that once in your blood, it can help you adapt to a lot of different conditions. If you have the flu or a cold, if your immune system is weakened, it can help you. It helps almost everything in the body to some degree. This is from the University of Connecticut, And here's what it says. This is an actual scientific article. And it says, studies from the University of Connecticut add new findings in the area of obesity. Black elderberry extract attenuates inflammation and metabolic dysfunction in diet-induced obese mice. And then it goes on to talk about how it turned off inflammation. Now, why is this important? And in what context? I knew a school teacher growing up who had the most wonderful magical garden. Now, it was no different than all the other gardens on our block, same size, but hers was just always beautiful. She had vines and flowering shrubs. She had every kind of flower, including aromatic plants, and she had like a little seating arbor, so you could sit under a trellis and drink. She would always make sassafras tea, and she would have her own beehive, and she had raw honey. And one thing she would always do is when I'd go by there, myself and some of our buddies would stop off, because she was always one of these jovial, upbeat, positive people. And she would say, every day, make sure you have cod liver oil, a teaspoon, and you won't like the taste of that, but make sure you also have the extract. And she would give us the extract every single day. And then she would give it to our parents to give to us, and we would take it. Now, why is that important to have the elderberry? Because it can help your body heal. It kills bacteria in the body that you don't want. It kills viruses in your throat. It helps kill candida in your intestine. It strengthens your immune system. So it's just an overall phenomenal tonic. So elderberry extract, and now it turns off inflammation. Well, think of all the people who have inflammation. How about every single person on the planet who's overweight? How about people with diabetes, metabolic syndrome, heart disease, cancer, arthritis, fibromyalgia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's? All of those are pro-inflammatory. So anything that can bring down inflammation is then what we call a cytokine quencher. It's taking the flame and turning it down. That allows healing. So make sure that you're taking your elderberry extract. Now, where do you get it? You can get it in a health food store and get the large size and get the concentrate. Do not get the one with alcohol. Get the quart size. It's not expensive. And take a teaspoon every day. Now, there's a magnolia. Well, if you're from Georgia, South Carolina, then the magnolia is just, you see it everywhere. I have magnolia trees. Some of the trees on my property are, I'm going to guess around 60 feet high. That means they're about 90 years old. They were planted a long time ago, back in the 1930s. And they're beautiful. I love the flower. But there's something else. University of Alabama found that the magnolia, not just, it's just beautiful, which it is, but it's also a natural medicine. Why? Because an extract it contains can serve as a cancer treatment. According to the new research in the peer-reviewed journal called Hanakao, the extract is in the bark, and that bark can then target the cancers of the head and neck. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal OncoTarget. So here we have a new extract. I'd never heard of it before. I'll spell it for you. Hono, H-O-N-O, Kiol, K-I-O-L, Hanakao. So that's important, and they did research on it, quote, from the University of Alabama. Head and neck cancers arise in the lip, nose, sinus, mouth, and salivary glands, and throat. They account for 3% of all cancers diagnosed in the United States, and about 75% are attributable to the use of alcohol and tobacco. Hello. Let's now look at an epidemic in cell phone cancers of the same area of the body, the head, the jaw, the lip, the brain. And in this, they did this study, and they took the extract, the Hanakao, and they used it against the tumors, and it worked. Quote, the EGFR is a protein that is associated with 90% of head and neck cancers. The results of this study are interesting. Now, they're suggesting more research, and they're always going to do that, and I would agree with that. But boy, when you show that it can do a good job, and it's an all-natural ingredient, good. A lot of us use lutein and xanthine. Why? According to Brown and Harvard Universities, they've come up with a good solution here. Quote, increasing levels of these two nutrients are associated with a 40% reduced risk of advanced age-related macular degeneration. The link between lutein and eye health was first reported in 1994 by Dr. Joanna Selden and her co-workers at Harvard University, who found a link between the intake of carotenoid-rich food. What do we mean there? Spinach, carrots, string beans, broccoli, and a substantial reduction in this, and this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Now, a lot of people are not aware of this, but your macula, MAC, M-A-C, ULA, U-L-A, is a yellow spot of about, 5 millimeters diameter on the retina. And the yellow color is due to the content of the carotenoids, lutein and zeaxanthine, which we derive from the diet. Now, these compounds are the only carotenoids capable of filtering the harmful blue light ray that can cause damaged cells in the eye and the rods and the cones. And a thin macular pigment can allow the blue light through and destroy the cells. While maintaining high levels of the macular carotenoids, and therefore the macular pigment, is seen how you protect your eye. So, this is a good study, and so make sure you're getting your vegetables. And vegetable juice is one of the best ways of getting it. Now, something else we should be getting, and lots of it each day, would be probiotics. Now, you can get probiotics by having non-dairy yogurt. You can have it in kefir. You can have it in milk. I'm talking about rice milk, coconut milk, almond milk. But also you can get it in sauerkraut. And you can get low-sodium sauerkraut also. You can get it in miso and tempeh. Or you can take a supplement. Whatever way you want to get it, get your probiotics. And if you have candida, I suggest you take it 3 times a day, starting at about 4 billion and working your way up to about 8 billion probiotics per day. That means that the good bacteria that are created by the probiotics will then be able to maintain a balance against the bad bacteria. And hence, your immune system will function better, your digestion will be better, you will have less likelihood of having gas, because gas frequently comes from having too much of the bad bacteria, and distension and constipation. So probiotics are good. This is from the Netherlands. Quote, probiotics can help prevent recurrent vaginal infections. And it goes on to talk about how it can be used also vaginally. You can put the vaginal capsules containing the lactobacillus, preventing bacterial vaginosis. And that's good too. And also, if you have candida, look at the natural douches using apple cider vinegar diluted and colloidal silver. Vitamin C shown to reduce flu and cold symptoms by 85%. This is a big deal, and this was published in the Journal of Manipulative and Physiological Therapeutics. And they looked at 800 students, and they found that vitamin C, in what we would consider a larger dose and what most people are used to taking, can make a big impact on this. So that's good when millions of people every year are suffering from all forms of going to the pharmacy or a clinic or community center to take something because of the flu or colds. And that's simply because our immune system gets challenged when the weather changes, and that's when most colds and flus occur. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and nothing they provide, nothing, will reverse a cold or flu. It can only reduce the symptoms, but that doesn't mean your body's healthier because of that. This was researched at the University of Florida, and they found that your primary decongestant was no more effective than a placebo. Then don't take it because there's a side effect. But vitamin C, yes. Now, my suggestion is you take between a vitamin C, and if you have trouble with it in your stomach, always mix it with a smoothie, with protein. It's also good to take it with, let's say, a plant-based protein, maybe 20 grams, and then you put your vitamin C. I would do 2 to 4,000 milligrams at a time, and generally that's fairly easy for most people to tolerate if you've been taking vitamin C. And then if you find yourself going through a stressful time or before you go on an airplane, take about 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C. Then every hour you're on the plane, take another 1,000 milligrams or up to bowel tolerance, meaning when you get a little upset stomach or a little bit of diarrhea, back it back down again. And not everyone can take vitamin C just straight. Sometimes you have to take it where it's buffered. Either way, it can help prevent a cold and flu. And finally, Tai Chi was found to be as effective as physical therapy for knee osteoarthritis. This is from Tufts University School of Medicine. And here's what it says, quote, both Tai Chi and physical therapy positively impact pain, function, other symptoms of knee osteoarthritis, making Tai Chi a viable treatment alternative for people suffering from the degenerative disease was the purpose of this, and it was done through the American College of Rheumatology's annual meeting, and they found that it works. So, for those of you who want an inexpensive, easy, really healthy way, because it's also meditation, Tai Chi is a meditation. So you can meditate, learn the martial arts, and help your knee osteoarthritis. And that's the latest in health and nutrition. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Now, this is a question for people in the audience. This is be a part of our later on talk back. We're buying a lot of stuff that we don't need. I believe in minimalism. I believe that when we clear the space we're working in and living in, when we look at what we need, we should be able to put it in three boxes. Personal items, hygiene items, toothpaste, toothbrush, and combs and brushes and shampoos, etc. Another one for reading material or things that we will get to, videos, books, articles. A third one for clothes. So how much clothes do you need? And what would happen if you started being more conscious of your clothes? Have you ever gone to any of the stores that have old clothes that people have contributed to the store? I found one of the most beautiful suits in my life. It was from the 1930s. I just had a little bit of tailoring do, minimal, and I wore it on PBS in New York on Channel 13 when I was doing my How to Live Forever special. You can see that. I'm putting photographs up today on my website. And you look at that suit, and it's a beautiful suit. Today, that would run you $3,000 to have that tailor-made. I paid $35 for it. So what happens if we exchange our clothes and then other people can appreciate the clothes that we've worn? So it's about uncluttering. And after all, why do we hoard all this stuff? But a lot of people who have a hole in their life, and we'll get to that, do this. This is from Madeline Somerville from The Guardian. Buying begets buying. How stuff has consumed the average American's life. Quote, the personal storage industry rakes in $22 billion each year, and it's getting bigger. Why? I'll give you a hint. It's not because vast nations of hoarders have finally decided to get their acts together and clean out the hall closet. It's also not because we're short of space. In 1950, the average size of a home in the United States was 983 square feet. Compared to 2011, it's 2,480 square feet. And finally, it's not about our growing families. This will no doubt come as a great relief to our helpful commentators on each week who kindly suggest that for maximum environmental impact, we simply stop procreating altogether. Family sizes in Western worlds have steadily shrunk from 3.7 to 2.6 from 1950 to today. So if our houses have tripled in size while the number of people living in them has shrunk, what exactly are we doing with all that extra space? And why the billions of dollars tossed to an industry that was virtually non-existent a generation or two ago? Well, friends, it's because our stuff. What kind of stuff? Who cares? Whatever fits, furniture, clothing, children's toys, and games, kitchen gadgets, and darling technical little appliances. It's all that and newer things. Equally, pretty useless. The simple truth is, you can read all the books and buy all the cute cubies and baskets and chalkboard labels, even master the life-changing magic of cleaning up. But if you have more stuff than you do space to easily store it, your life will be spent a slave to your possessions. We shop because we are bored, we are anxious, we're depressed, we're angry. And we make the mistake of buying material goods and thinking they are treats which will fill the hole, soothe the wound, make us feel better. The problem is, they're not treats. They're responsibilities, and what we own very quickly begins to own us. The second you open your wallet to buy something, it costs you in more ways than you might think. Yes, of course, there's the price tag and corresponding amount of time it took you to earn that amount of money. But possessions also cost you space in your home and time spent cleaning and maintaining them. And as the token environmentalist in the room, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind you that when you're buying something, you're also taking on the task of disposing of it, responsibly or not. And when you're done with it, what do we do? Our nation is addicted to consumption, and it's a vicious addiction, and it's stressing us out. So that's Madeline Somerville and her statement. Now let's hear from George Carlin.
I would have been out here a little bit sooner, but they gave me the wrong dressing room, and I couldn't find any place to put my stuff. And I don't know how you are, but I need a place to put my stuff. So that's what I've been doing back there, just trying to find a place for my stuff. You know how important that is. That's the whole meaning of life, isn't it? Trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is. Your house is just a place for your stuff. If you didn't have so much goddamn stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. That's all your house is. It's a pile of stuff with a cover on it. You see that when you take off in an airplane and you look down and you see everybody's got a little pile of stuff. Everybody's got their own pile of stuff. And when you leave your stuff, you gotta lock it up. Wouldn't want somebody to come by and take some of your stuff. They always take the good stuff. They don't bother with that crap you're saving. Ain't nobody interested in your fourth grade arithmetic papers. They're looking for the good stuff. That's all your house is. It's a place to keep your stuff while you go out and get more stuff. Now, sometimes you've got to move. You got to get a bigger house. Why? Too much stuff. You've got to move all your stuff. And maybe put some of your stuff in storage. Imagine that. There's a whole industry based on keeping an eye on your stuff. Enough about your stuff. Let's talk about other people's stuff. Did you ever notice when you go to somebody else's house, you never quite feel 100% at home? You know why? No room for your stuff. Somebody else's stuff is all over the place. And what awful stuff it is. Where did they get this stuff? And if you have to stay overnight at someone's house, you know, unexpectedly, and they give you a little room to sleep in that they don't use that often, someone died in it 11 years ago, and they haven't moved any of his stuff. Or wherever they give you to sleep, usually right near the bed, there's a dresser, and there's never any room on the dresser for your stuff. Someone else is on the dresser. Have you noticed that their stuff and your shit is stuff? Now, sometimes you go on vacation, you gotta bring some of your stuff with you. You can't bring all your stuff, just the stuff you really like. The stuff that fits you well that month. Let's say you're gonna go to Honolulu. You're gonna go all the way to Honolulu, you gotta take two big bags of stuff. Plus your carry-on stuff, plus the stuff in your pockets. And you get all the way to Honolulu and you get in your hotel room and you start to put away your stuff. That's the first thing you do in a hotel room. Put away your stuff. I'll put some stuff in here, put some stuff down there. Here's another place for some stuff here. I'll put some stuff over there. You put your stuff over there. I'm putting my stuff over here. Here's another place for some stuff. Hey, we got more places than we've got stuff. We're gonna have to buy more stuff. And you put all your stuff away, and you know that you're thousands of miles from home, and you don't quite feel at ease, but you know that you must be okay because you do have some of your stuff with you. And you relax in Honolulu on that basis. That's when your friend from Maui calls and says, "Hey, why don't you come over to Maui for the weekend? Spend a couple of nights over here." "Oh, no. Now what stuff do you bring?" Right, you've got to bring an even smaller version of your stuff. Just enough stuff for a weekend on Maui. And you get over, and you're really spread out now. You've got all over the world. You've got stuff at home, stuff in storage, stuff in Honolulu, stuff in Maui, stuff in your pocket. Supply lines are getting longer and harder to maintain. But you get over to your friend's house in Maui and they give you a little place to sleep and there's a little window ledge or some kind of a small shelf and there's not much room on it, but it's okay because you don't have much stuff now. And you put what stuff you do have up there. You put your imported French toenail clippers, your odor readers with the 45-day guarantee, your cinnamon-flavored dental floss, and your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And even though you're a long way from home, you know that you must be okay because you do have your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And you relax in Maui on that basis. That's when your friend says, "Hey, I think tonight we'll go over the other side of the island, stay at my friend's house overnight." "Oh, God. Now what do you bring?" Now you just bring the things you know you're gonna need. Money, keys, comb, wallet, lighter, hanky, pen, cigarettes, contraceptives, Vaseline, whips, chains, whistles, bills, and a book.
And that's stuff. So think about, have you been one of those people trapped by clutter? And you know, it's not just possessions. It can also be people. The need to have people as if they're just an additional item in your life to fill that void. I'd like to hear your perspective on how you've come to grips with this, if you have. 888-874-4888. And I want to share some insights on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'm very concerned about it. I believe we have to have a national effort of unifying all the different disparate groups together into one. Because if this goes through, this will be the worst piece of legislation I could imagine impacting us today and in the future. We would literally lose all of our protections when it comes to the environment, to products, to safety. It would be a corporatized world completely. So let's hear what John Pilger has to say about this.
Banking, software, pharmaceutical, and tobacco corporations are lobbying governments from 12 countries to negotiate the dirtiest deal you've never heard of. There's a reason you haven't heard of the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership. There are some major corporations and government officials that don't want you to know what's in the deal. For one, our food safety standards, environmental protections, and local labor laws could all be threatened under the TPP. We could all be forced to pay significantly more for the medicines we need. And you could be fined or even sent to jail for downloading copyrighted content on the internet. How will they know if you do it? Because your internet service providers could be required to watch your online activity. But that's not even the scariest part. The TPP gives corporations the power to sue our government in secret foreign tribunals over any law or regulation they claim affects their expected future profits. Don't believe it? It's already happening. Recently, after Canada said U.S. big pharma corporation Eli Lilly's drug price raising patents were not legit, the firm sued the Canadian taxpayers for a staggering $500 million. And now billions of dollars are being demanded from Germany after it decided to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima disaster and improve environmental standards for coal-fired electric plants. Philip Morris and Chevron are in on the game too, raiding taxpayer dollars and trying to reverse crucial policies we all rely on. Thankfully, not everyone is willing to sign on the dotted line just yet. In fact, most government officials still have no idea what they're even signing on to, for good reason. So far, Democrats and Republicans in the House of Representatives have united against fast-tracking the TPP. But there is a mighty corporate lobby that wants to make sure the deal is signed and railroaded quickly through Congress before we know about the damage it will cause us. We must get our senators and representatives to stop fast-track. Here's the deal. Without a strong public outcry, politicians will only hear the concerns of multinational corporations. And once the TPP is signed, it's here forever. There's no expiration date and no separation clause. This dirty deal has been deliberately branded as a free trade agreement. It is anything but free for people like you and me. And it's not really about trade. It could cost us our internet freedom, labor rights, access to affordable medicine, the safety of our food, and protections that keep our water and air clean. Nobody wants to be stuck with a backroom deal we don't want and never voted for. Find out more, speak up, and spread the word.
And this is one more comment on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
It is about a final control. And it's the United States saying there may be another power in the world, but we will be the ultimate power.
Quite explicitly, the US and the EU are saying that they want these new trade agreements to form the blueprint, the template for all future trade deals. And that means they're rewriting the rules of the global economy, and that means for everybody.
Once signed, it will cement a key part of the US government's plan to create a new global bloc that will ensure the dominance of its largest companies. And to understand why, we need to go back to the 1950s.
See the USA in your Chevrolet. America's asking you to call. Drive your Chevrolet through the USA.
After the Second World War, the United States accounted for half of the world's economy. Its influence was unmatched by any country, and it was able to write the early rules of international trade to its advantage. The World Trade Organization was created in this context, and the U.S. dictated rules that favored American business. But as economies like China and India joined the WTO, it became a more democratized arena, and the U.S. found it harder to control its decision-making.
At the WTO, at its Doha rounds, India spoke up and Brazil spoke up. And the U.S. lost control.
I think it's no use beating around the bush. This meeting has collapsed.
The U.S. felt it needed a new strategy to maintain its global dominance. So in the classical American style, they went big. To bypass the WTO, they're creating the biggest international agreements that the world has ever seen. They're called the Three Big T's. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, and the Trade in Services Agreement, or TISA. And they're all being negotiated in secret right now.
We only found out when WikiLeaks was able to leak parts of them.
And what's interesting is when you look across all of these deals, whether it be TTIP, TPP, or TISA, China is excluded, but also Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, they're all excluded because those are the emerging economies.
What is not often understood is that these agreements are part of a geopolitical war. This is a new war which is taking place between the United States and China. The United States is very scared of the rise of China, so it has moved to militarily encircle it through what is called the pivot to Asia, and now it's moving on to doing that economically.
The basic idea which comes across from reading US strategy papers is the construction of a new grand enclosure, and to put inside this grand enclosure the United States, 51 other countries, 1.6 billion people, and two-thirds of global GDP. To integrate Latin America away from Brazil and towards the United States, to integrate Southeast Asia away from China and towards the United States, and to integrate Western Europe, pulling it away from Eurasia as a whole and towards the Atlantic.
Of the three big T's, WikiLeaks has revealed four chapters of the TPP, which affects 12 countries in the Americas and Southeast Asia. We also obtained and released the core text of TISA, which affects 52 countries, including the EU. But nearly all of TTIP is still secret.
Nobody knows about what's being negotiated in our name. So you have these far-reaching deals which are going to completely change the face of our economies and our societies, and yet even elected parliamentarians know nothing about it.
The world's biggest corporations don't have the same problem. They have been receiving VIP access from day one, and have had abundant influence in the negotiations.
People, the likes of you and I, are excluded. Governments, to a great extent, are excluded. Those who are included are the multinational corporations.
These agreements are basically corporate ownership agreements. The funny thing about free trade agreements, as we understand them, is they often have nothing to do with trade in the sense of the mutual lowering of tariffs. What they're about is enshrining an investor rights regime in the respective countries and ensuring that corporations can run wild in the respective economies with very, very little regulation or impingement by government or authorities.
These treaties will have huge, huge implications for literally almost every critical issue that an individual citizen or community would care about: health, education, the environment, privacy, and access to medicines. I mean, the list could go on.
One of the most criticized aspects is a system called the Investor State Dispute Settlement, or ISDS. It's a secretive international tribunal that allows companies to sue states over virtually anything that they can claim affects their investment.
If a protest affects their profits, they can sue. If laws affect their profits, they can sue. If new regulations might impact where what they want to do with their money, they can sue.
This is a new power which will be handed over to US corporations to sue the governments of Europe in a parallel judicial system which is available to them alone. So people have no access to it, domestic firms have no access to it, governments have no access to it. It's just there for foreign investors, in this case, US corporations.
Based on ISDS history, critics argue that European state sovereignty and democracy are at serious risk. Previous lawsuits include Swedish company Vattenfall suing the German state for $3.7 billion for phasing out nuclear energy. British American Tobacco sued Australia for passing a law limiting cigarette advertising. The French company Veolia sued Egypt for raising the minimum wage.
What we're dealing with here are extremely nefarious corporate interests who just want more power. Power, in its most oppressive forms, is deployed not only by various repressive government policies and intelligence agencies, but also through a predatory market-driven culture that turns violence into entertainment and foreign aggression into video games and domestic violence into goose-stepping celebration of masculinity and unbridled militarism. According to Professor Henry Giroux, who we've had on this program many times, he was on Bill Moyers talking about this. I have that clip up on my website. I want you to see it. Because at the same time that we're being told, don't worry, these are all going to be for your interests. Wasn't that exactly what Bill Clinton said and Hillary Clinton said about NAFTA and GATT and CAFTA? Look at the consequences. They lied. Why? These are wealthy, powerful people. These are celebrities. Why do they have to misguide us, mistreat us? Because it's now a part of their sociopathic personalities, in my opinion. And at the same time, the increasing circulation of public narratives and public displays of cruelty and moral indifference continue to maim and suffocate the exercise of reason and social responsibility. What we have been witnessing in the United States ever since the 1980s and the Reagan-Thatcher disavowal of all things social, all things public, now it's everything privatized. It's a kind of hardening of the cultural markets by an increasing indifference to matters of empathy and the erasure of ethical considerations. And evidence of such cruelty is everywhere. We see it in the words of West Virginia Republican lawmaker Ray Canterbury, who, without irony, added a requirement to a bill intended to end child hunger and a provision in which school children would be forced to work in exchange for free lunch meals. As he put a quote, "I think it would be a good idea if perhaps we had the kids work for their lunches." Really? Under what conditions? Well, Newt Gingrich has made a similar argument, one that is even crueler, if that is possible. At a speech given at Harvard University, he argued that it was time to relax child labor laws, which he called truly stupid. Really? Child labor laws are stupid? Now, you call yourself a historian. Well, Newt, do you want to tell us about what it was like waking up at the age of 7 in a mining town in Katanning, Pennsylvania, and working 12 hours at the steel mills for 12 cents a day and having a life expectancy in the 20s? You want to have us go back to that time of exploitation? Because the treaties we're talking about would allow the total exploitation of labor. It would destroy all labor unions. And it, mark my words, as it would destroy the unions, let's see which heads of unions have the courage to go against the corporate Democrats on this. I'll be interested in seeing the outcome. How often the head of unions betrayed their membership? So where Gingrich mimics a neoliberal ideology that separates economic actions from social cost, he seems to be clueless about whether 9 and 13-year-olds could perform work that is often backbreaking, brutalizing, and sometimes dangerous, including tasks such as working with hazardous chemicals and fixing basic plumbing and cleaning floors and toilets. To impose this type of work on poor children who allegedly need it to teach them something about character, in my opinion, borders on insanity. At the same time, Gingrich seems clueless about keeping poor children in school and has no qualms about putting school janitors out of work if they don't need to make a living wage to pay hospital bills and put food on their table. Neoliberalism is what this is all about, and it's produced a broad landscape of cruelty, precarity, and disposability. We see and hear it in the words of Republican candidate Ben Carson, by the way, a creationist, who believes completely in the idea that if you don't work it on your own, you shouldn't have it. There's also the now notorious example of Donald Trump, who emphatically stated that Mexican immigrants are largely rapists and drug dealers. The culture of cruelty and the hatred that promotes it appears to be completely divorced from any sense of reality and social responsibility or reason. For instance, Andy Kessler, a wealthy hedge fund operator, insisted that homeless shelters generate poverty because they bring people into a web of dependency. Well, Andy, have you ever had no money and no capacity to feed your family? If you haven't, How can you judge those who have and say it's their fault? There's more at stake here than the ignorant babble of insulated, wealthy sociopaths, meaning all your corporate Democrat and Republicans combined. This is a kind of behavior on display reminiscent of Christian Bale's character, Patrick Bateman, the wealthy investment banker in the film American Psycho. And more recently, there was the egregious case of the insufferable Martin Scorsese, the 32-year-old chief executive of Turning Pharmaceuticals, who raised by 5,000% a drug used by patients affected by HIV and cancer. The price of a pill went from $13.50 to $750, imposing an enormous financial hardship on patients requiring the drug to fight potentially deadly infections. But he was saying that, hey, he owned the company, he could do what he wanted, and he is correct. Price gouging will be the norm. So don't expect anyone as a signatory or benefactor of these new treaties of looking at you and saying, what do you need that I can supply in a humane way? It'll be, what can I do to exploit you and know that your government, your laws, will not be able to interfere in that exploitation? And if I have to manufacture a product next door to your house, and if there's terrible fumes in the air and leakage into your water, too bad. Your EPA won't be able to stop us. Another instance of the culture of cruelty can be seen in the high-octane and unethical grammars of violence that now offer the only currency with any enduring value of mediating relationships and addressing problems and offering instant pleasure in the larger culture. This is evident in the transformation of local police forces into SWAT teams and schools modeled after prisons, and in the ongoing criminalization of social behavior, and especially of poor youth of color. Brute force and savage killings, replayed over and over in various media platforms, now function as a part of the autoimmune system that transforms the economy of genuine pleasure into a mode of sadism that saps democracy of any political substance and moral vitality, even as the body politic appears to weaken itself by cannibalizing its own young. And boy, do we cannibalize our young. Needless to say, extreme violence is more than a spectacle for upping the pleasure quotient of those disengaged from politics. It is also part of the punishing machine that spends more on putting poor minorities in jail than on educating them. As U.S. society becomes more militarized, civil society organizes itself for the production of violence. As a result, the capillaries of militarization feed and mold social institutions extending across the body politic, from the schools to local police forces. In the United States, local police forces in particular have been outfitted with full riot gear, machine guns, armored vehicles, and other lethal weapons imported from the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan, reinforcing their mission to assume battle-ready behavior. Is it any wonder that violence, rather than painstaking neighborhood police work and community outreach and engagement, become the norm for dealing with young youth, especially at a time when more and more behaviors are being criminalized? The police in too many cities have been transformed into soldiers, even those who do not wish to. And it is not a condemnation of the majority of police, because the majority of police have committed no crimes against the citizens, but a minority have. And we should pay attention, because it becomes a cancer that will inevitably metastasize, harmonizing at the lowest possible level of human existence. Go along to get along and protect those, even if you weren't the one personally responsible. SWAT teams were deployed about 3,000 times in 1980. This year, over 50,000 times. Some cities use them for routine patrols in high-crime areas. Baltimore and Dallas use them to break up poker games. Others use them to serve summonses. Such egregious use of police time and taxpayers' dollars would appear unbelievable if they weren't so savage. In the advent of the recent display of police force in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, it is not surprising that the impact of the rapid militarization of local police on poor black communities is nothing short of terrifying, and yet deeply symptomatic of the violence that takes place in authoritarian societies. And we should pay attention, because this is just the beginning. We are now looking at a neo-Darwinist ethic in terms of Orwell. Morality loses its emancipatory possibilities and degenerates into a pathology in which individual misery is denounced as a moral failing. Under the neo-Darwin ethos of survival of the fittest, the ultimate form of entertainment becomes the pain and humiliation of others, especially those considered disposable and powerless, meaning all who no longer have power. They populate the stories we are now hearing from U.S. politicians who disdain the poor and see poverty as a result of immorality. Jeb Bush echoes this argument in his claim that if he were elected president, we wouldn't be giving black people, quote, free stuff, drawing on racist stereotypes about black America being lazy and plagued by pathology dependence, which is not true. These narratives can also be heard from conservative pundits such as New York Times columnist David Brooks, who insists that poverty is a matter of the poor lacking virtue, middle-class norms, and decent moral codes. Really, David? And when was the last time you lived amongst these people? For Brooks, the problem of the poor and disadvantaged can be solved, what he say, through, quote, moral education and self-reliance, high-quality relationships and strong family ties. Well, I can show you a lot of people who have all the above and are still poor. In this discourse, soaring inequality in wealth and income, high levels of unemployment, stagnant economic growth, and low wages for millions of working Americans are willfully glossed over and covered up. What Brooks, Bush, and other conservatives, and Hillary Clinton especially, and predominantly the Clintons, they've caused this suffering, and they want to consistently obfuscate in the idea that, gee whiz, more on the war on drugs. Clinton and the rest, and Bernie Sanders, does not want to decriminalize. And also, why don't we judge them by how they judged Edward Snowden? They're willing to say Snowden should be put on trial and punished. And I say, you are wrong, you're a fascist. The man who exposed criminal behavior should not then be deemed a criminal, but rather the people who were exposed for criminal behavior should not be protected, as you have and will continue to protect them. If that is not Orwellian, I don't know what is. And so there we are. As the claims and promises of neoliberal utopia have been transformed into an Orwellian nightmare, the United States continues to succumb to the pathology of financial speculation, political corruption, and the redistribution of wealth upwards into the hands of the 100th of 1% to the top 5%. The rise of the surveillance state, the use of criminal legal system as a way of dealing with social problems, and at the same time, Orwell's sinister fantasy of an authoritarian future continues without enough massive opposition. Students, low-income whites, and poor youth of color are exposed to a low-intensity war in which they are held hostage to a future of low expectations, police violence, and an autonomizing consumer culture. A growing anti-intellectualism and religious fundamentalism in society, corporate and government modes of surveillance, and the burden of extreme debt. Higher education no longer models itself, however weakly, after a public good or as a protective space to think critically, question, engage, in thoughtful dialogue, and learn how to hold power accountable. It now functions as part of the higher education to corporate pipeline, and hence why we should join together and reject all of the treaties and the politicians who support them. Let us go now, in our closing moments, to Evelyn Pringle. Evelyn is one of the voices of consciousness in this society. On a daily basis, sometimes weekly, we see columns of where she is bringing critical issues from around the world to our attention. Nice to have you with us, Evelyn.
Hi, Gary. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us some of the issues you're going to be dealing with starting today on your new radio show at 5 p.m.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Gary, for giving me the opportunity to have a talk radio show. I have been working hard, like you said, on on Facebook putting out all the information, and I'd say it's to put out to the people who are limited to the mainstream media who don't get the facts. And so I decided to name the show Focus on the Facts, and I'll be covering a lot of what you were just talking about here as I was listening, and the media and the mind control in the media and by the media. And, you know, how about these few corporations all own the media. And it's so distorted, the news on there, that I for years have not watched cable news or mainstream media news, but lately I've been putting it on in the morning and listening to what they say, and by now I can tell you that what they say, what is actually happening is the opposite of what they're saying. You know, I mean, because they're alarming things, like now it's always bad stuff about Russia and Putin and everything. And I'll think, oh, did that really happen? And then I'd be like, no, when you go on the computer, you're going to see it didn't happen. The opposite happened. But this lying to the public about everything is really scary to me.
It is not scary to me. It is predictive. What is scary to me is when people begin to adapt to the lies and then no longer engage in critical thinking. And that is the biggest problem. Evelyn, we look forward to Focus on the Facts today at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Network. All right?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Finally, let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. See, in the Huffington Post today, there was an article about Hedy Lamarr. And I know for a fact that you knew her, or you know her, and I wondered if you can give us your perspective on Hedy Lamarr and some of her accomplishments versus what most people would think of her.
Most people would remember Hedy Lamarr as considered the most beautiful woman in the history of Hollywood. And indeed, subjectively, that might have been true. What's important is that Hedy would have been 101, I believe, today, on her birthday. I knew a different Hedy Lamarr. I knew her after she had retired from Hollywood, as I knew many of the screen legends, Greta Garbo and Gloria Swanson, Myrna Loy, many. And I met them through them having health issues and, you know, me helping with their health issues. I was young as a young nutritionist, and they were these people who had retired. First, I found them to have great sense of humor, Hedy Lamarr in particular. What people didn't know about Hedy Lamarr is she was an inventor. She was a scientist. She was a critical thinker. She was a leading feminist. She wouldn't take alimony from any of her husbands, including one who was one of the wealthiest men in the world. She wanted to do things on her own. She didn't want to be subordinated by the standards of society. She was a renegade at every level in her life. She also was one of the inventors of the original Wi-Fi. In fact, she actually has patents. If she were alive today, she would have made billions of dollars. And yet she passed in a small little, you know, home in Florida and forgotten. And that's the real story. When people who have contributed something to society and then they're no longer part of what's important to us, they become irrelevant. And they shouldn't. We should respect the people who are relevant and understand the relevance, and the internet allows us a chance to see what we wouldn't have otherwise known. When we didn't have the internet, how would you know this? How would you know someone was an inventor? How would you know someone's a great writer, a poet, or a painter? You wouldn't unless there was a spotlight on them. And I believe that we should be able to take a look at all the wonderful human beings in our society, on our planet, and learn what gifts did they have now, even if they're not any longer in the spotlight, so we can better appreciate them. Because I find great joy in conversations with remarkable minds. Many of those are older individuals who are no longer in the mix of things, but once were. And if you only knew how interesting and engaging these people are. Hedy Lamarr, she wanted to be in the country. She couldn't afford it. She was up at my place, a farm, for months at a time. And she would have notebooks filled with all of her invention ideas. But she was not, she did not miss film when she was out of it. Most of the people I know who were former Broadway or ballerinas or opera or movie stars, television, when they're out of it for a while, they readapt and readjust to the life they have, and hence they're not stressed, and they can enjoy themselves. And there's legions of these people around. And you ask a young person today about any of these people, and they have no idea they are in existence. That might be a project for someone. Creating a website that spotlights, highlights people who have contributed something to society, something to our joy, something to our pleasure of life, and even if they're alive or dead, highlight them like an old reel. Here are some things you didn't know about someone, and find some joy in it. I wonder what it would be like if we took all of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and Eleanor Powell and some of the old greats and had showed them one day in every class in high school and college in the United States. What do you want about that 99% of those people don't know who they are and would suddenly find absolutely mesmerizing and exciting talent because they only know what's up on their Facebook today as if history didn't exist before they got their little gadgets.
You're right.
Okay, thank you, Luann. And also, by the way, one last thing. Luann is interviewing people who are interested in being a part of a homesteading project. And Luann, do you want to give your number?
Sure. It's 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. If I'm not there or I'm on the line, just leave your name and number, say you're interested in the homestead, and I'll get right back to you.
Okay, thank you. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned. We have Utrecht Lead coming.